Welcome to the Talking Legal Ed Podcast with Professors Linda Jellum and Billy Joe Kaufman. In each episode, we explore cutting-edge legal issues with renowned legal scholars and teachers. In these explorations, we discuss the legal doctrines implicated in the issues we tackle. But perhaps more importantly, we look at how legal educators can bring these issues alive in the classroom.
Joe, look who we have looking at us. It's our former dean, Kathy Cox.
This is going to be a great conversation. So much background in so many ways. So let's get to it.
So looking forward to talking to Kathy, president of Georgia College and State University, former law dean at Mercer University School of Law. Also former president at Young Harris. You have had many academic jobs, and we want to talk about those today. Before we get started, and it's so great to see you, let's start off by just, how did you end up where you are? What brought you to the place that you're sitting right now in the presidency?
It's so good to see both of you. Could we just chat for a while
and talk about
legal ed? You know, my whole academic career is just such a fluke. I never in a million years intended to be in education or in the academic world. I intended to practice law for a long time and got into politics. And then, as I say, the voters of Georgia decided that I should do something else after serving as Secretary of State for two terms and taking a shot at governor. I got a really off-the-wall call from trustees at a private college up in the mountains of North Georgia that they were looking for a president. And I thought it surely must be a wrong number because I knew essentially nothing about administration at the college level. And long story short, they hired me to be the president of this small college, small liberal arts college. And for reasons I'll never understand, other than maybe serendipity and the good Lord's will at a great Methodist college, they took a chance on me. But in hindsight, they were looking for a president with very different skills to grow the college from 2 to 4 years, to heal a lot of personal and personnel situations, to raise a lot of money. And they found that my background, particularly in politics, brought a lot of those skill sets to the table. And I had a great 10-year run there before I got this other off-the-wall call from my alma mater, Mercer Law School.
Let me stop you there. Let's talk about Young Harris for a moment. You came in, never having been in legal education, and kind of, you know, leapfrogged over everybody, took the president's role. How easy was that?
You know, in hindsight, it was not real easy, but I knew going in that I did not have the expertise and I needed to surround myself with people who knew a lot more than me. I knew I brought some strengths to the table that the trustees obviously had some confidence in, but I had a good team already in place. I added others to the team. But we were really in a fast change mode because I knew the mission was to grow and to change the college from a 2-year model to a 4-year model, which is essentially like building a 4-year college from scratch. And so they wanted a change agent. And that was something I did have some skills at doing through my work in politics and otherwise. And I felt like I could be a good organizer and motivator and visionary to help drive sort of the vision and the change for that campus to see a bigger picture and a different way forward, and had an incredibly good time and a great learning experience immersing myself in the liberal arts experience over the following 10 years.
So many of those students became Mercer Law School students, and they speak so highly the work you did there and their own personal undergrad experience. So it does take a village to put all of that together, but the students are the real beneficiaries. So
it certainly does. And certainly I took a personal interest with undergraduate students who were interested in law school because of my background and experience. And they were not shy about coming to talk to me. And I always asked them to come and talk to me if they were interested in law school. We did not have any law JD members of the faculty. So I gladly took on that role there and encouraged students to come and talk to me about pursuing law school. And I thought for a lot of them at a small liberal arts college, they would find the environment at Mercer Law School, the personal environment at Mercer Law School, not too dissimilar from what they had at Young Harris. So they, I did follow all of them and their successes at Mercer and was very proud of them, as I still am with my students at Georgia College.
So, and then you said you got a call sort of again out of the blue from your alma mater, from Mercer, which of course is where we both met you, to be dean there. And so what did you think about that opportunity?
Well, I honestly never thought I would leave Young Harris. I had such a good run there, but the Mercer opportunity struck me, I guess, at the right time, at the right place. And after a decade of leading significant change on a campus, I could sense that my campus was a little bit weary of change and maybe weary of me. And I guess to go back to the cliche of better to leave when they want you to stay than to stay when they want you to leave, I thought maybe seeing that there were still a lot of changes that campus needed to experience, that maybe it was a good time to put a bookend on the 10 years I had there, maybe a new leader for that campus for the next big change might be healthy. And I guess if there was one element I knew personally for me, for my husband, for our family, I wanted to be in a city for a while. The Young Harris College is a beautiful campus in the North Georgia Mountains, but it's quite isolated and remote. And I missed a lot of people and friends and the accoutrements of a city. Y'all might not think of Macon, Georgia, but listen, it was to me and still is. I'm a small town girl. And I love and still love Macon. And I was ready for that kind of change. If I could have picked up that campus and put it in a city, would have done it. But I personally, that was a good change for me and my family.
So when you came to Mercer, how different is it being a president versus being a law dean? Now, so most people do it the other direction. You sort of went both ways. but it's more common to be a dean and then become president. You sort of went from a small college president to maybe a larger college with a dean and now being president again. What are the different skill sets in the two roles?
It was more different than I thought it would be. I thought it would be fairly similar because I anticipated that the law school would have a level of autonomy, and it did, both physically, of course, as you both know, the law school at Mercer University is not on the main campus. It's a mile or so away on a hillside, on a top of a hill, looking over the city of Macon downtown. And I thought there would be maybe a little more autonomy than there was. The president of Mercer, of course, is a lawyer. I had in the back of my mind there might be some micromanagement of the law school. That was not the case from his standpoint. But the level of control that a dean had was minimal compared to what I was accustomed to as a president. And that was a big adjustment.
So part of the reason that the new president position at Georgia College might have appealed was to get back to the level of A, being able to do change again, because it seems like you really enjoy change, but also sort of having that level of control that you were maybe missing when you were a dean. So what has been sort of the biggest challenge in your current position as president of Georgia College?
Well, the interesting dynamic, of course, for those who may be listening today, Mercer University and my first institution were both private institutions. I'm now at a state institution for the first time. And of course, I have this background in state government of serving as Georgia's Secretary of State. And serving in the legislature. And so I knew state government. I know the state budgeting process. I know the people in state government. And all of that, I think, is beneficial to my institution. But I had not worked in the university system of Georgia, which constitutionally has some autonomy from the rest of state government by design in the Constitution. And so there is a good bit of bureaucracy, shall we say, in state government that when you're in private higher ed, you sort of have this envy of state schools. You know, oh, they don't have to raise all this money. They get state appropriations. How lucky they must be. And then when you're there, you see how you have to, you know, sort of beg and scratch for that state appropriation you get. And there's a formula that drives things that doesn't always fit what you need, or certainly what you and your campus want to do to accomplish your goals. So you have to work within that system, which is very different than a private college or university, where I used to say at Young Harris, if I can figure out something for my campus and figure out how to pay for it, my board is probably going to let me start on it tomorrow. Nothing moves that quickly in the state university system of Georgia. You know, you can plan something and a couple of years down the road, you might see it get started because things do not get funded quickly. The budget process moves very slowly and is sort of backwards looking, in fact. So there's a lot of bureaucracy that I've had to figure out and, of course, make adjustments to work within.
Is some of that your political background and your legislative background has to be helpful? Are there ways to be innovative and creative and say, okay, 1 year, 3 year, 5 year steps, or is some of it you can't even start thinking about until it's funded?
Right now, it's an interesting dynamic because you have to be in an institution, I think. You have to be in an institution that has a mechanism for generating funds, or you really are sort of operating at the whims of the system, shall we say. And the system, the funding formula is so antiquated in Georgia. It dates back to the early 1980s for higher education and has not been changed since then. And it is based purely on enrollment, headcount, and credit hour production. And so there are no provisions for rising fuel cost, or no provisions for, hey, we want to do this startup program that will really address workforce needs in the state of Georgia. There's nothing entrepreneurial about the funding formula to help you start something up. So you've either got to cannibalize something or eliminate a functioning program to start something else, or just wait and hope and cut and scrap and that kind of thing. Now, obviously, there's always fundraising, and that's been a little bit of the bane of my existence, trying to get a good, stable vice president of advancement in place to help me stabilize and develop a really good, solid fundraising program since I've been here. And so that will come into its own sooner or later. But it's not a funding system that meets the demands of higher ed today in large part.
I'm at a state institution first time and see some of what you're talking about as well, having come from a private institution where it was pretty much we could do what we wanted, how we wanted. With a state system, you just have a lot more bureaucracy on top of everything. And sometimes that bureaucracy is very good, but sometimes it is not. And it's, I think, when you're fighting the uphill battle. So a question that I have, you know, many of us are in dean searches right now. Mercer is not, but Idaho is. And you've been a dean and you've also been a president. So I think that a president who has been a dean in particular is going to have a very different view, perhaps, of what would make a good law school dean than me as just an academic and what I'm looking for. So do you have thoughts that you could share in terms of what you think makes someone successful given the experiences that?
Well, looking at, I guess, at my own experience of being, I think, hired to be a change agent in my first presidency and going into the deanship at the law school, I anticipated being somewhat of a change agent. I think the administration wanted me to be somewhat of a change agent, but I did not find a faculty that was looking for a change agent. I think you both might agree with me. And so that was a strange environment to tackle, because I really don't think I had ever worked around an environment that didn't just love to change. I don't just love to change for the sake of change, but I guess I've always been in environments where I felt like change was essential for the health of any kind of workplace or organization, particularly any kind of competitive workplace or organization like we all are in higher education, that you have to keep changing and stay abreast of things and try to stay ahead of your competition. And that there was not that embrace of that need at the law school. And I didn't find any tools in my toolkit to really move that forward. And so I didn't feel particularly effective there in doing or leading or motivating things that I think might have helped the law school in the short and long term. So, you know, maybe it was me, maybe it was the timing, who knows, maybe somebody else will find better approaches than I ever took. But I'm on a campus now that really embraces change and the need to live and thrive in a competitive environment, because we're one of the three selective admission universities in the university system of Georgia. So we go head to head with the University of Georgia. Georgia Tech is the other selective institution, but they're, you know, a different breed of university on the tech level and engineering level. But we know we've got to really be at our best game to attract the best students in Georgia, particularly, and maybe in the larger Southeast and national level. Or we don't have a shot at these really smart students that have a lot of choices. So not only do I have a campus that sort of wants to change programmatically, but it's refreshing to have a faculty that are eager to learn new pedagogy and think about new ways of teaching themselves how they might teach. And we have a really active Center for Teaching and Learning that is always rolling out workshops and helpful things to the faculty that they seem to embrace. Nobody's having to bludgeon them into attending workshops or, you know, they roll it out and the faculty go, and even in the summers. And so it's a really fun kind of environment to work with people like that are always get excited about new ideas and things like that. But I'm rambled around your question, I guess, about a dean, is that certainly from a president standpoint, we have hired some deans since I've been at Georgia College. I like to look for deans that have a little bit of an entrepreneurial streak, that are going to bring good ideas to the table. And I would say that almost about anybody that I hire. I don't want to have to do their jobs. There's a job description attached to every job that I hire for, but I want people who will take that and always bring me five other ideas about what we can be doing from their position to improve the institution. And maybe we can fund them all. Maybe we can only fund 50% of them, but boy, how exciting it is to have somebody bringing new ideas to the table besides me. No institution is going to be healthy if just the president is doing this top-down idea generation thing. So it's great to have deans, vice presidents, provosts, who are all good idea people, and then who know how to implement those ideas. We can all sit around and dream, have a beer and think big thoughts, but people that really know how to take an idea and put it into place and know how to make the wheels move behind it are people I really get excited about working with. The other piece, I guess, for both hiring a president, hiring a dean, is having fundraising experience. And if you don't have experience, at least having a desire to learn fundraising and get over the phobia of fundraising. And I particularly say that about women, but it's certainly not a gender-based thing. But I think women get less opportunities to do fundraising and for various reasons. And so they seem to have more of a fear of fundraising. But in both public and private higher education, fundraising is a necessity. And so if you have fundraising experience, it automatically moves you to the head of any kind of search, because everybody is looking for somebody who will be able to add resources to the institution.
Sometimes that fundraising piece too is just personality and knowing people and just liking people.
I guess they call it
working a room, but if you don't have a strong desire just to chat and have a beer, it's going to be more like another appointment on your day rather than, oh, gee, I'm going to go get to see John Doe to raise a little money. One of the great things that I know you loved was your teaching at Mercer Law, and particularly the election law seminar. And I know you've taught some other courses in the past. Do you still get a taste of teaching, whether it be workshops or panels, or because you have a kind of a special way of going about that? And I don't know if you get time to do that once you're a president.
I have not had any chance in the 2 years that I've now been at Georgia College. I would hope down the road I might have a chance to do some sort of seminar. We have a very interesting sort of first and second year seminar style courses where we really, they're very topical and very, timely, sometimes controversial topically, but they are elements through which we teach the liberal arts skills of critical thinking and analysis and those kind of things. So we use those to drive students into the real liberal arts experience here. And I'd love to teach one of those sometimes. But the great thing to me about the teaching experience that I've had is what it has taught me about what it takes to be a good teacher. And especially from legal education, it didn't take me long to appreciate how many of my good friends over the years in the state bar love to call up the dean and say, well, I'd love to just come down there to Mercer Law. I want to retire and just tell war stories to those students at the law school for the next 3 or 4 years. Don't you want to pay me to do that? And that's what so many people think teaching is all about, is just standing up and telling war stories about your years in practice. And to actually get into teaching and understand teaching, I don't know that I ever have felt good about my teaching, because I've never had the time to do it well. And that's one of the key things that I've learned, that to be a good teacher, you have to be given time to do it well and to prepare well. And so many people that in state government and that serve on fiduciary boards want to make light of, oh, these faculty are so coddled and they only teach 2 courses or 4 courses or whatever, because they think that all you do is just show up for that 1 hour and tell a story and you're done. because they don't have any concept of the hours that it takes to really hone in on a topic or a subject or some minute point you really want to get across to students, and you want to have all the expertise in the world to drive that point across. And that's where I've always felt rushed in my teaching, you know, and trying to prepare well and being a president at the same time or a dean at the same time, because, you know, I have 20 other irons in the fire. But I do have this enormously greater value for what it takes to be a good classroom teacher, because it's not just teaching and it's not just about you conveying the information. Today, particularly, it's about how you engage those students in the conversation and in the discussion, and how you engage their neurons to learn the subject matter. And there's just so much to the science of learning that I've read about and learned about and thought about. And I'm not telling you all anything you don't know, but it's been a wonderful learning experience for me.
Seems to me, back to one of the things you said before, when you started at Young College, you surrounded yourself with experts, and you were just talking about the importance of having taught. You now understand sort of your faculty in a way that would be different had you not ever a class, whether it be law school class or any class. And you said something to me one time in a private conversation we had where you said you would not hire a dean that hadn't had higher academic experience. And I thought I would ask you to explain that to our audience a little bit, because there are a lot of people non-traditional. And to be fair, you were a non-traditional candidate when you went to Young Harris. And yet you're saying, I wouldn't hire me in most cases. Obviously, they needed something that was a little different. But why do you think that there's some risk, shall we say, in hiring a non-traditional dean?
Yeah, that sounds pretty hypocritical, probably, I guess, for me to say something like that, given my own pathway. But I guess anybody hiring a non-traditional dean would need to really evaluate whether a non-traditional dean is coming in with an open mind to learning about higher education, or whether they're coming in thinking they already know everything there is to know, because I've seen some of that as well. And that usually does not end well for them, or certainly for the unfortunate people that have to work with them and try to continue to do what they know must be done to teach well in any higher education setting. If they're open to learning, then certainly I'm the poster child for showing that it can be done. And hopefully somebody along the way thinks that was of value, but it's certainly not the norm. I think a lot of non-traditional people, even that have talked to me about, oh, I want to get into higher education at this level, that level, don't understand what I've been through. And I can tell from their comments, they think they're just going to waltz in and it's going to be just like the practice of law, you know, just like handling some clients, or, you know, just like whatever they were doing. They don't have any knowledge of the deeper processes, the deeper elements of learning, the science of learning, the concepts of what struggles students today have, and what baggage. I mean, good gracious, what I've learned about poor students, what they bring from all kinds of family situations that impair their ability to almost function, much less learn. And that, you know, I have two younger sisters that have been in K-12 education all their lives. And I've certainly heard plenty of stories from them over the years about student situations, but I've seen so much of it myself now to have much better appreciation for the whole learning spectrum, that you just can't walk in without some knowledge of that and think you're going to serve an institution of higher education very well, if you don't know it or you're not willing to really spend some time learning it from people who do.
What about the just major higher ed issues of, for instance, the enrollment declines and rankings? And has that changed over time? It seems like we used to live and die by rankings at law schools, but I don't know, now they come out and the world goes on. And I guess some people follow them very closely, and others, I don't know if they follow them at all or know what date they're coming out on. But I mean, I've known of deans of law schools who've literally lost their jobs because of rankings or because of bar passage or any other number of things. So is part of your job to educate the trustees or the higher ups so that they're prepared to understand their constituencies and their faculty and their students in a better way?
This is a very good question. I guess the way that I've looked at rankings over the years I've been in undergrad education and legal education is a little different. That it's just sort of a marketing game, pure and simply. And those
sales magazines.
Yeah, those of us in it know it's a game. It's just like, you know, spending some money for advertising. You want to get the best ad out there you can put the best light on your institution. But at my first institution that was originally a two-year college going to a four-year college, we could not get ranked for many years because before the Carnegie Institution gave up Carnegie classifications, they would not reclassify my institution. Even though we became a four-year institution by all accreditation standards, they just wouldn't bother with reclassifying. I mean, they just quit doing classifications for about 3 years, honestly. And then they gave it up to Indiana University. Mm-hmm. Whoever does it now does the Carnegie classifications, but Carnegie itself gave it up and quit doing it. And so we couldn't get classified as four-year institution, so we couldn't get ranked. And it was mind-boggling that these parents would come up to visit us and say, oh, this is such a great school, but I've got neighbors who won't come up here to see you because you're not ranked. I thought, wow. So you knew it impacted some segment of the market in a way that you just had to learn to play the game. And so we eventually overcame that. But then as a newly ranked four-year school, you were having to just work your way into the system. You know, I'm grateful I never have worked at an institution where anybody was going to put my head on the chopping block because we didn't move up or down or to the right level in the rankings. And Mercer has had its share of woes on the rankings. And now it seems, right as I was exiting the law school, that so many of the top law schools were just blowing off the rankings that really gave them all a big hit. And the rest of the folks were like, well, okay, it's there. We'll do what we can with it. But I don't think it has as much impact maybe as it used to because those top echelon schools just sort of walked away. Now
you don't, you don't hear students really talk about it like you used to.
Yeah,
that's true. I don't know about parents, but
you know, I feel like we would be remiss. We have listeners maybe who are current deans who may want to be president, right? We've talked about, you know, what it takes if you're on a, say, a dean search committee or a faculty or a dean. But what about for those people who are maybe deans or maybe in other positions and are thinking they'd like to become presidents? What do you think is the most important set of skills for somebody to be a good president?
Well, I think that most deans need to figure out how to expand the reach of their exposure before they really start pursuing those president's positions, because I have some friends who are deans who have been through that route, some with great success, some have struggled, and some of those who had a harder time finding a presidency. Number one, never got good fundraising experience as a dean. And that was a real impediment to them becoming a president. Everybody looking for a president is going to want a president that can or will or know how to raise money or has had experience raising money. And so a dean needs to become best friends with an advancement leader at your university and say, how can we start raising money for my college or school? How can I learn how to be an effective fundraiser? There are plenty of good conferences that teach dean level leaders how to do fundraising at that level and how to engage with an advancement department. So embrace it. Because the whole crux of fundraising for charitable fundraising in higher education is matching your needs to a donor's interest. So, you know, donor A might be really interested in your moot court or mock trial program because that's what they did in law school. And you need somebody to support that program. So matching your needs with their interest, hey, you got a big donor to support it. Somebody else might have only been to law school because they had a great scholarship and now they want to pay it back. And so it's just a matter of developing relationships with somebody. And sometimes those relationships can come quickly. Sometimes it might take a year or two or more to get to a really significant donor. But if you like people, that can be very fun and interesting and engaging. They really do believe in and want to see flourish or help students like they knew it helped them. But that fundraising is key, but also getting involved in personnel matters, knowing how to make hard personnel decisions, nut-wrenching things to go through, but it's also a very good learning process to understand both the legal requirements, the personal way to do it, to be compassionate and empathetic to a person who may have to be terminated. Just learning and being able to explain that to a search committee helps them know you could maybe deal with some problems on their campus. All of those things to just really dig into more than just, I came in every day for a few years, turned on the lights, and, you know, we had a great law school experience. People are going to be looking for a president who can make hard decisions and raise money.
I think it's been so fortunate that I've had as much experience with accreditation and standards, and because none of that is necessarily fun, but you still have to do all of that, both on state levels and regional levels. But you also meet a lot of colleagues and mentors in that way that have been really, really helpful to my career. And I think people forget about, oh, that person they were on a site visit with, you might pick them up and, you know, call them on the phone, because everybody's had some situation you can learn from. So Linda, this is pretty interesting. Can we just keep her for another 2 or 3 hours, or maybe she has other things that are important today?
You think the president of a university might have something more important than talking to us on Talking Legal Ed. So Kathy, yes, thank you so much. It's been really interesting sort of and fun to watch your career. It's really sad. I think we, Billy Joe and I both really miss working with you. I will say you were one of the best deans I ever worked with. I have a dean now, but I really enjoyed my time with you, and I appreciated the responsibilities and leadership opportunities that came my way from your leadership. So it is sad that you are all the way across the country from me, not too far away from Billy Joe. So I assume you two will get together sometime. But
well, we keep trying. So
I knew she was
a good president. Bob and I take adventures for lunch and dinner sometimes. And a couple of waitresses at a restaurant near Kathy told me how great she was. And when the students feel that way about you, you know, others do as well. So
I don't know that I even knew the president of my university. So anyway, Kathy, thanks again so much for your time. We appreciate it. And we look forward to seeing you sometime around Macon or Milledgeville.
And both, the one thing I didn't mention that certainly both of you helped with is to be a good leader, you've got to have a good sense of humor. And both of you make sure that that was a weekly, if not daily, part of my job. So thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome. Pleasure. And best to Mark. We're thinking of him.
Thank you. Great to see you both.
Bye-bye.
Thanks so much for listening. Please come back for our next episode when we interview another nationally recognized legal expert. Talking Legal Ed is edited by Tim Spieshock. Artwork by Kaylee Jellum. Please look for all our episodes wherever you find your podcasts. And please don't forget to leave a positive review if you like the show.